And welcome to another edition of Zoomed In. I'm your host, Brandon Chapman, and it's a pleasure to be joined today by Catherine Rodella, a friend who is at WC Vancouver and has been doing awesome work for the College of Education and is not just a faculty member, she's an associate dean. So Associate Dean Rodella, Associate Dean of Equity and Inclusion. I want to make sure I get this title right, so I'm getting it off. The faculty and staff, like that's your focus. We have another associate dean for equity and inclusion that focuses more on student success. And you've been an associate professor in educational leadership at WC Vancouver. I think I got all that right, Catherine.
Yes.
So, I hope so. Anyway.
You got it right. Yes.
Oh, okay. First of all, how is the most beautiful campus, WCU Vancouver? I just absolutely love it over there. It could be raining. It could be a nice clear day. It's just gorgeous over there. How are things at WCU Vancouver?
Great. Beautiful. It's finally started like cooling down, which is wonderful. But the clear skies, my office has a beautiful view of Mount Hood, and I'm so grateful for that. It's gorgeous.
And one day you'll be a full professor and you'll have Mount Hood. You'll have a corner office and you'll see Mount St. Helens on the other side. So
I'm going to make them put there's one place on campus. You can see them both at the same time. I mean, well, not at the same time. You do have to turn, but there's like, it's right in the middle of campus in the quad and you can see St. Helens and Hood. So maybe when I become a full professor, I'll say, no, I want my campus or my office to be right smack in the middle. I demand it because that's what I'll become real mean.
That's right. You've earned it. I've earned this. So for quite a while, you've been teaching classes in equity and social justice leadership, you've worked really hard to diverse communities. A lot of outreach for communities, and specifically some of the research you've done is, hey, let's increase the number of leaders of color, let's help our students to have teachers and leaders that look and sound like them. And I've always been attracted to the research that you've been doing. So before we talk about National Hispanic Heritage Month, which is one of the reasons that I had you here, let's talk about your research. What are you doing? What are some of your cool projects?
Yeah, no, thanks. I mean, I feel like my research is also a reflection of myself. So I do think as a Latina and third generation Mexican-American, it's a part of it. I didn't start looking at diversity and leadership until I got this job. And really, it wasn't because I was like really interested in studying administrators. I was really interested in studying Latinx families and working with families. And I have been doing that, continue to do that work in communities. But it was really in the relationship with my students and realizing I had maybe one, two, three students of color in our program of like 20 students, right? And I prepare all my students to engage in equity and culturally responsive education and leadership work. But what struck me was some of the barriers that the students of color had to face that other students really just didn't. So for example, I had a student who, his first language is Spanish, and but he spoke English perfectly. He grew up in the States, had a slight accent, and it was like every little typo he had in an email got picked up by his supervisor and principal. Every little thing he did wrong related to language was like, you got to work on that. And like things that I do all the time, and English is my first language, things that anybody would do who's an English speaker all the time. And it was like those little microaggressions, and he just was like trying so hard, and wasn't really supported. And in these little ways that were just critical. And finally, they had a professor that looked like them that just was open to talking about it. And I can't tell you the hours I spent in my office, closed door sessions, tears, emotions, anger, frustrations coming out that became a part of my job because of just who I am. So I really leaned into it. It was hard at first, but then I realized I was like, this is why I have this position and this is what I want to do because over time, as I started to do research with Latinx leaders, and then it became across racial groups and cultures, because I realized like we needed to unite across difference to be able to talk about some of the challenges of being a leader of color in schools. and some of the comments you get from families. Like I've had colleagues who are principals share, like, you know, I was at the, like, after school, and I'm walking the hallways, monitoring things. I'm going to a meeting with the superintendent, and a parent stops and says, could you point me to the principal's office? And they're like, I'm the principal. Like, I need to talk to the principal, you know? And they're like, oh, what? Like, they assume that they were like, oh, I thought, no, the principal, not like you. Like, they thought, like, she didn't understand the question. And then they basically came out and were like, no, we want to talk to the person in charge. And she's like, it's me. And then it comes out, they're like, well, we thought you worked like a cafeteria. Like, so, I mean, it was really bad. It was okay. It went down way worse than that. I'll tell you the truth. Like, it went down way more racist than how I'm explaining it.
That's already pretty bad.
It sounds racist. No, it was much worse. So I mean, that kind of stuff that like leaders carry with them, but it's like, you still want to do that for the, you still want to be there for the students. So what I've learned in my work is like a lot of the leaders of color who went, most of them to schools in the US, like they just don't want students to have to face the stuff that they did. Right. Or they had an amazing experience and they want to, you know, they do want to support students from all different backgrounds. And so it's led to what I'm working on. You know, I'm still associate dean, but I am also doing sabbatical work, and I'm doing a project and been building and working in partnership with Vancouver Public Schools and our colleague Sharon Cruz, who's the department chair for educational leadership and sport management, and also our academic director in Vancouver, and on the project called the Southwest Washington Leaders for Equity and Advancing Diversity Program, or the Southwest Washington LEAD Program. And it's will be a cohort of 20 future leaders of color in Southwest Washington, which is actually really transformational. Like that changes like so much. Like there's so few leaders of color, administrators of color, that it really does change like what our schools can look like and be like for students. Yeah. So don't get me started on my research.
First of all,
because then I just go. We can't.
No, that's okay. First of all, thank you for having an acronym for that. And the acronym makes sense too with LEAD. What is that practically speaking? What does that look like? I mean, one leader of color can make a huge difference. What does that look like to have 20? And just last week, I went to something. It was a residency training, medical residency. And of course, all that data was thrown out there like, you know, people stay within 30 miles of where they do their residency. And so how important it was to you know, be rural and get more doctors that are rural because they'll stay there if they do the residency there. What does that look like for a program where they're there in Vancouver or maybe in the area around about, whether it's Battleground or other places near Vancouver, to actually change the look? I mean, are these folks going to stick around Washington? What does the data look like? Or are we guessing on some of that?
So, I mean, I know that some of the data, and it's tricky because especially at the principal level, so districts have to track teachers of color, right? So, and all these people are currently teachers of color. So we know in the state of Washington, we're talking about maybe, you know, 10 at most 15% of educators or leaders of color are 15%, like 10 to 15%, sometimes higher depending on the district, that percentage is like teachers of color make up that percentage, right? So it's really pretty small. And in Southwest Washington schools, especially schools like Vancouver Public Schools and Evergreen Public Schools, they're getting close to like 50% students of color in their schools. So it's a real kind of gap in representation. But the other piece is it's good to focus on representation and that students see examples and role models in front of them. But actually research is starting to show, and literally like as in the last 2 years, we're starting to get quantitative research, which is not the research I do, but I lean on it, showing the impacts of leaders of color. And so part of it is it's representation, but that they're seen to like create more culturally responsive schools. They bring all that knowledge and lived experience into their jobs. They've been seen to increase teacher retention across racial groups, but especially teachers of color. They've also been seen to recruit and promote teachers of color in their schools. Like they'll tap and say, I have this paraeducator or I have this mom. She would be an amazing educator. I'm going to help her go and get her degree, right? So like we're seeing these examples of of the real impacts of leaders of color on school outcomes too. Like we see attendance go up for students of color. We see more students of color in talented and gifted programs, AP programs. And part of it is that it is their cultural knowledge, but they also don't necessarily see those communities from a deficit lens, right? So there's a lot of unlearning that all educators have to do to say like, students from low-income backgrounds, students who speak another language other than English, or students with disabilities, like there's all these things they can't do versus flipping it and saying, what are the things they can do? And so leaders of color, and I would argue leaders from who have those lived experiences of marginalization, they've lived it. They know what they can do and they see that possibility more readily in other students and other leaders. And so that's the when I think about what it means, it's just so, it almost makes me emotional. I know it's made some of the collaborators I have emotional. One of the district leaders in Vancouver, you know, after our last meeting where we're planning this, like we're going to do a session at the end of October. It's a recruitment session, but it's also like literally helping all the people like, okay, this is an application. Here's the program. What, and think about your strengths. Think about how you talk about your leadership journey. And she stopped me at the end and we were walking out. She's like, I'm going to retire not that long from now. And this is legacy work. She's like, we're just going to change. Like, think about like what it's like. And I'll say anecdotally, like my son goes to a school, he went to in his elementary school and it was, he's only had teachers of color. He's had teachers that just look like him, which is unbelievable. I never had that. And he just thinks it's normal. He thinks a superintendent looks like a Latino person. He thinks like, he doesn't even think about it. And it's unbelievable to me. I'm like, cause I don't see that. My first Latina teacher was in college. It's my Spanish teacher. Like I never had someone, a teacher of color, until I was in college. So, you know, there's just these things that it isn't quantifiable at this point. You know, we won't really know how many are in the workforce until they graduate with their certificate in a couple years. But I do think that we're going to see these ripple effects for years. And, you know, my mind is we're making the change that needs to happen. And, you know, I'll work with some of our amazing researchers, my colleagues, to figure out how to measure those impacts.
See, I'm glad I asked that question. You're obviously very passionate about it, which I think is amazing, right? I appreciate that. You mentioned this being part of who you are, right? When we talk about heritage as a Latina woman, of course, the person in the hallway at school probably wouldn't have known that English was your first language. They would have made an assumption, right? Mm-hmm. Which is too bad. I still can't get off of that. I can't get off of that, you know, these biases, I think, that we have that, I don't know, they say inherent biases. And sometimes it's hard to unpack whether it's an inherent bias or just racism, Catherine. I mean, I don't know.
Racism. Yeah, it's socialized. So, we've been socialized to see that a principal looks like this. I mean, even if you ask me, I'm like, oh, that guy looks like a principal. He's tall. He's a basketball coach. He's a high school principal, right? Like that, there are these stereotypes of what we think certain people look like, right? So that's unlearning it and also seeing the possibility when we unlearn it. Like that student who had all those microaggressions thrown at him in his emails, everything was nitpicked. He's an incredible, he's been an administrator in like three different schools. He's an incredible administrator. Faced some of the toughest like gang-related issues at the schools, dealt with it, amazing. He's an incredible administrator. So that's the kind of thing is like, can we start seeing the possibility in and unpacking the stereotypes we grow up with? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's vital. I mean, I may be somebody who has a sense of empathy, but maybe lack certain experiences that it just, you can only be so effective, I think. But if you have those lived experiences, man, that makes you stronger in so many ways, you know, being able to identify and be a leader for the kids. So I think the project sounds amazing. What kind of timeline are we talking about with this?
I mean, we're waiting on funding, but we're making plans. It's supposed to start in January. So it's coming soon. I mean, we just have it. It's one of those things where it's like, we hold it and we're like protecting it. And then when we're ready, it'll be a big I guess I'm announcing it now. Don't tell anybody. Is this going to be shared? No, just kidding. Yeah, no, it's great. Like we're talking about January. It's starting. No, we're going to do it. And I think that's, to me, it's just looking back and thinking of like, building on the experiences and the challenges and the pain that I bared witness to and walked alongside my students. You know, these are all, it's building from that. It's building from like what I experienced as an educator. I was a high school teacher. I was the only Latina Spanish speaking high school teacher in my school. And I know what it was like to navigate and walk alongside families and to be that person they'd come to ask for support. So it's not just the barriers are like overt racism. It's also the, like, it's the I don't say sacrifices, but the kind of, luggage, like the toll you kind of carry on, right? The extra work you carry on because it means so much to you, right? Like, so I used to do that as a teacher. I do it now as a professor.
Now let's talk about the Mes Nacional de la Herencia Hispana, the National Hispanic Heritage Month. I say that in both languages, but what's interesting is I know a lot of people who are very proud of their heritage that don't speak any Spanish. You know, and I even remember telling one gal, I it's too bad, right, that her mom didn't raise her in speaking Spanish, and she said some of the lost language is just part of who she is, right, and the journey in their family to try to assimilate, and and now at this point they, there's some regret there, but she's still very proud of her heritage. What does heritage mean to you? And I think it's interesting that many of these months and weeks of celebration used to just be called history, like National Hispanic History Month. Mm-hmm. And now instead it's called Heritage Month, right? Which I think is powerful. But talk about heritage and why you're proud to be Latina.
I mean, I think I came to this over time. So part of it is, as I think about my growing up, assimilation is also a part of our family. So my first language is English. My parents' first language is Spanish, but they also grew up speaking English right away. They were born in the U.S. in El Paso, Texas. I was born in El Paso, Texas. And my grandparents came to the U.S. as children. And actually, my dad's father was born in the U.S. too, and his family has been in Texas or Texas forever before it became part of the U.S. When we say the border crossed us, like, we really mean that on that part of the, in that side of the family. One of the pieces, heritage to me is so important, but it's also that recovering and healing that happens because of assimilation. So I learned Spanish a little at home. My parents would speak it more as Spanglish, right? Like a mixing, a translanguaging of English and Spanish. But I learned proper or like grammar in school, in high school Spanish. And, for me, one of the reasons I know my parents, one of the things that they weren't ashamed or ever told us to be ashamed of speaking Spanish or being Mexican American. It was more of, we want to protect you from the racism that we faced in schools. So for example, my parents went to schools in the 1950s, 1960s in El Paso, Texas. At that time, the policy around language was total English. You got in trouble for speaking Spanish. My dad was hit for speaking Spanish. Like they were spanked for speaking Spanish, right? So it was a survival of like, you're gonna be, our children are not gonna have accents. And my parents, I think, don't have any accent, but sometimes people say they have slight ones. Like, I don't hear it. But I do think that you carry with it because you're trying to survive in a country that says you need to be like one of us and melt away all, like be the melting pot, melt away all the diversity in your heritage, right? But you still keep those elements of yourself. You still keep those pieces that mean so much that you can't let go. You know, and I think as we grew up over time, we lived on Air Force bases. My dad was in the Air Force for 20 years. So I didn't live in El Paso. I would travel and visit there in the summers, which is the perfect time. July and August in El Paso is a million degrees. And somehow my parents thought that was the best time to visit family, but that's when we would go. And, but on the Air Force bases, like it was truly a, like all different cultures and diversity. And so for me, it's been a coming to learn, relearn, regain the language, the culture. And I had a professor, so going back to kind of some research stuff, I had a professor in grad school who talked about this idea of replenished ethnicity. His name's Tomas Jimenez. And this replenished ethnicity means that like when you have more Latino immigrants around for like later generation, and he studied Mexican Americans like me who grew up on Air Force bases, but then also we settled. My dad retired. I was 14 years old. We moved to Portland, Oregon. And at that time, we started seeing more Latino immigrants from Mexico, from Guatemala, from Central America coming in. And according to my professor, and I actually really lived this, seeing things like Mexican sweetbread, seeing taco, panadillas, seeing places you can go buy tacos, seeing these businesses come up, replenished my Mexican heritage to be like, I see this around me more. I feel more in touch with my heritage. And so I experienced that, and also trying to learn the language, right? And so for me, it's been important to recover that, to learn it, to study it. And then now my son, which I think is such a beautiful story, my son is in Spanish immersion, right? And I try to tell him, Papa and Tita used to get in trouble if they spoke Spanish, so you damn well better learn it. Screw you, racism. We got you now. We're going to have him learn it. And, seeing that, to me, it's a political act, but it's also a recovery, right? I think about, the world does turn towards justice, right? But we have to keep working towards it. So that's why I think it's so beautiful. And of course, he definitely is. I was every time he's oh, I don't want to do this. And I'm here comes the lecture. Dad, come in here, talk to your papa, talk to Tita. You're going to learn about this. And so that's a part of it is to me, being Mexican American is so important, but also it's the constant fight against the forces that want you to assimilate. Right. And I see it in so many spaces, being a professor, what does a professor look like? Do they wear big hoop earrings? Do they wear red lipstick? The things that I love, but also knowing I've had to navigate that. Yeah.
So thank you for sharing that. So what was supposed to be the purpose of the Hispanic Heritage Month? It says recognizing contributions and influence of Hispanic Americans to the history, culture, and achievements for the United States. It feels like a window dressing sometimes. Mm-hmm. Let's call a month what it is and then let everybody be happy. And there's just a sense sometimes I feel like we placate people. Let's do Indigenous Peoples Day. Let's do that. But what actually is transpiring that brings about good? I don't know. And I don't know if it's going to be for this month, which, by the way, is actually from the 15th of September to the 15th of October. It's kind of a weird time frame. And before I forget, by the way, it was 1988 was the year it was put in. And the reason that stood out was because it used to be a week long back in the 60s, LBJ put it in. And this month now, October, is also National Disability Employment Awareness Month. And so I'm talking to some ROAR folks about some of the things that they're doing. And that was in the 60s. And then it was put in a full month in 1988. So it seems like in 88, everything was being made a full month.
Reagan did it.
Reagan did it. But as I think, well, regardless of the month from the 15th to the 15th, what I really like is that you're doing something, right? This LEAD program is actually making, I think, strides toward letting all of the individuals who want actually feel, I shouldn't even say empowered, the empowerment should be there, right? You're already empowered as a person to be able to celebrate your heritage. But, so unfortunately it's almost like permission granted, but it is going to allow our children to honor their heritage and not be afraid, not have to take that same unfortunate journey where you're in trouble if you speak your language, you're looked down upon if you speak your language. Let's give these students, young students, capacity to celebrate their heritage and not have to worry about, the negative. So anyway, just a thought.
Yeah, no. And I think it also is part of it is I wrestle with these Heritage Months. They feel very performative. They feel very we did it. We celebrated the Latinos. You're welcome. Or in February, well, we celebrated Black History next year. Right. And so, but then at the same time, it's because we wish you didn't need them, right? But at the same time, I'm bringing to the forefront and talking about also the complexities and diversities of the Latinx people. The erasure that's happened, the struggles that have happened, you know, one of the challenges also with Hispanic History Month it was in 1968, but it was also seen as like trying to make everybody into Hispanics, because at the time you had the Chicano civil rights movement happening, and it was like radical Mexican Americans saying like, we demand our rights. There were a lot of college students in California, like demanding ethnic studies, demanding these things. And so part of it is like, it has this complicated history, but I also recognize that there is some pride and almost like, again, I almost think of it as like a healing situation for many of us that grew up in spaces and in places where we weren't celebrated. We were told to just conform, and what that feels like to be able to say like, you know, there is some celebration, you know, in Portland, and I work in Vancouver, I live across the river in Portland, but they have El Grito, right? Which is the celebration of Mexican Independence Day and September 16th, right? So even though it's weird to go from, the month is like across 2 months, it's, you know, September 15th is the Independence Days for, and I wrote it down because I didn't want to mess it up, it's Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. And then September 16th, Mexico and Chile, like a lot of Latin American countries celebrate their independence from Spain. And so, you know, part of it is that, I guess what I'm seeing now is that there is a place for really intentional honoring and acknowledging, but also honoring and acknowledging the diversity of the really diverse Latinx community, right? That, and the really complicated Latinx community. There's lots of, I just think that there's lots of space for it, and that there still is a purpose, even though it's a complicated month, just like any of these heritage months are.
Right. I know, and I actually, what I speak is Castellano de Argentina, mm-hmm. and that their July 9th is their Independencia. I know the official name is National Hispanic Heritage Month, but Hispanic, Latino, I've mm-hmm. heard you mention Latinx, right? Which is mm-hmm. a more of a newer way to, I guess, avoid maybe the inherent patriarchy that's in the Latino, Latina, you know, masculine O, feminine A. I don't know, for anybody who feels confused, right? I keep thinking, and guess what? Let's work through that. Let's just work through it and learn and grow, and we'll figure it out, you know? We'll figure it out.
Yeah. So, and I know, you know, like my parents
closing off doesn't help anybody.
Yeah. Well, and I think my parents call themselves Hispanos. I'm not about to go tell my dad, like, I'm sorry, dad, you know, don't use that word. But also like my dad was just telling me at work, like my dad's 72 and I wish he would retire, but he just loves his job, which I love that. Right. So let him keep working. But he was saying someone came up to him, right. Cause he's Latino or he's Hispanic, Mexican American. And they're like, what's up with Latinx? Like, what's up with that? Why are people doing it? And my dad, who I'm just like, who I can also be seen, you know, I could have imagined back in the day, be like, yeah, I don't know. Why are these people doing this? Like this woke media, whatever. No one actually uses it. But the point is what he said is like the language changes, how people change and why they do it. And like he was very eloquent in saying that. And he's like, you do it to be inclusive. So part of Latinx is also the like recognizing gender non-binary, transgender, Latinx people, and recognizing that the embedded kinds of homophobia, transphobia, cissexism, like all these kind of, like we're trying to do better, right? So I think, you know, for my dad who's 72 years old, who grew up in those schools where you get hit, you speak Spanish, and grew up in a very machista culture with very, you know, at sexism, he raised four girls, four strong daughters, kept trying for a boy, never got one, right? He raised four girls. And now he can explain that and understand that language changes because we know better and we do better now. I think that tells you something about kind of how people grow and change. And so I don't mind it still being called National, you know, or Hispanic Heritage Month, because that's part of the history, right? That word. I don't call myself Hispanic, but I still have to mark that category when the census comes along. So like, you know, again, complicated history and recognizing that we're going to keep learning and doing better, but we have these categories that we don't exactly fit in. And all these racial categories are really complex and don't, you know, mean as much to me as like my Mexican heritage, or the Dia de los Muertos altar that we always put up, or all the celebrations and my family's traditions and values, that means more. So yeah, I don't mind it though, even though I appreciate you mentioning that.
Yeah. Well, and in the meantime, again, keeping an open mind and working through like our ignorance or whatever it may be. I think if we have an open mind, eventually we'll get there, you know? Yeah. So I don't know. I like the progress. And again, I have a lot of hope just based on not just the LEAD program. You know, to be clear, you're doing a lot of other things and you have been for a long time. That actually, to me, it's like the fruits of your labor. You know, you see it, you see positive change. Mm-hmm. We've used that phrase, agents of change, at the College of Ed for a long time. And I think it's, I don't know, it's pretty evident. And, you know, your son, who, by the way, I've seen is a good golfer, too.
He's a great golfer.
He's got teachers and that are his people, you know. I mean, he sees something and he's going to be, I don't know, I have a lot of hope in our youth that they get opportunities that maybe some past generations didn't have. So,
yeah,
certainly a more global minded.
Well, and I also think like, I mean, when I think about all
you were going to say,
when I think about all of this, I think it's about allowing people to be their fullest selves and respecting the inherent dignity of every person. Like that to me is what equity work is really about. Are we creating spaces and institutions where people can be their fullest self and be celebrated for that? That there's not the push to be someone they're not, and also not harm that we're causing. And a lot of our institutions, like schools, like universities, have done that. And that's my hope. That's my hope in my professor work, in my classes. It's my hope in my research. And that's also my hope in my associate deanship, right? Like, you know, we're doing things that honoring the work that's happened in the College of Education, but also seeing like, you know, we're starting with Amir Gilmore, the other associate dean of equity and inclusion, the associate dean's LGBTQIA+ advisory council, like just to bring visibility, right? So I think that to me is what I feel like the heart of my work is about, is creating spaces and institutions where everyone can be their fullest selves and belong.
Really well said. And so let me ask you if you have anything else you want to add. Otherwise, we'll end on that because it was really well said. But if you have anything you want to add, now's you know, the mic is yours. So
no, I think that's it. I mean, I appreciate just the time and space to talk about these things. Like I forget, you get so busy in the what you're doing that you forget the deeper why. And I think having these moments of like reflecting on that it's been really helpful because I've been so busy that I actually thank you for making me do this podcast with you, Brandon.
Yeah. I'm glad you were voluntold to do this podcast.
That was not
all right. Catherine Riddell, associate professor. Yeah, I know. and leadership associate professor at WC Vancouver, also a phenomenal associate dean for equity and inclusion at the College of Education. Thank you, Catherine. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Brandon.